Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 529. In this episode, Scott talks with Tinsel founder and CEO Ania Williams about bootstrapping a hardware startup.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, we're talking with Ania Williams, who is a founder and CEO of Tinsel, and you've got a successful hardware startup.
Yes. Well, it's funny to say the word successful. I will call it successful. Let's see. Once we start shipping product, then I will say it's successful.
good point. Yeah, there's a lot of press when cool hardware things come out. So when you see someone's face in the news, you think, oh man, they're so successful. But you're right. Until all of the customers are happy, that's when success really starts, doesn't it?
Exactly.
So at this point, you're estimating that you're going to deliver somewhere in the middle of the year here?
Yeah, at this point, it's looking like potentially May, June. Mm-hmm. We just got an update from the factory yesterday, and we're having some fun times with plating, where we're trying to really nail the color finishes the way that we want them to be. And so there's some fun things that have happened where we got them pretty solid when we did the prototyping, but the material composition was a little different because the process that they make the prototypes with is different than they do when they're making it at scale. And so now we have to kind of realign the coloring with the new one. So that's a fun one.
Okay, very cool. So let's back up and let's talk about what the vision is and what the product is. What did you create?
Yes. So Tinsel, our first product that we're bringing to market, is an audio necklace, as we like to call it, which, is a necklace that has the functionality of headphones built into it. So all of the details of the electronics are embedded within the details of the jewelry.
So that seems like something that people would have done before, but I can't think of anywhere I've seen this before.
Well, it's funny because when the whole thing started, it really was this pain point that I had. I use my headphones every day, but they're buried at the bottom of a bag. They get broken. They get lost. My husband takes them. It's a vicious cycle. So I figured that this had to have been a solved problem, that, you know, I wanted to be able to wear them on my body to avoid some of these issues, but you know, not having them look like headphones. And so I was looking all over for this product that I felt had to exist somewhere. And it didn't. So then eventually I kind of got this bug thinking that maybe I could be the person to make this product. And that's how it all started, the genesis.
It's funny how that works on the internet. You know, you think to yourself, it's so big and there's so many people out there, it must already exist. And when it doesn't exist, you still can't believe it.
Exactly. It's amazing.
So this is a piece of jewelry that it goes around your neck and it is indistinguishable from any other piece of attractive, well-made jewelry, right? It doesn't look like headphones.
Exactly. It looks like a necklace. And then when you're ready to use it as headphones, you basically can transform it into your headphones while still wearing it.
And you said that there's electronics involved. How much smarts does this headphone have?
Yeah, so I guess if depending on how you qualify something as being smart, it's actually quite dumb in the sense that there's no chips in it. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's not totally true. There's a remote part that's in there, so it can control the volume. Yeah, exactly. But in the sense of, you know, something that needs to be charged, it's not. And that was very much intentional on our part. So, just as you think of, you know, the headphones that most people have are wired headphones, that you just plug into that 3.5 millimeter, plug on your phone. This is how Tensil works as well. So smart in terms of the innovative design, but we really tried to keep it as simple as possible, from a technology standpoint, because it allowed us to, you know, execute more quickly, but also avoid some of the issues that, other wearable devices have with power and charging.
Mm-hmm. And when you decided to do this, did you think it would be something that would be straightforward, or did it feel to you like this was a big task? Like, when I think of like prototyping and manufacturing, I don't have any sense of what scope is. I don't know if it's a company or if it's a hobby or if it's a lifestyle brand. I mean, how do you size something like this?
Yeah, that is a really great question. Cause it makes me think that, like, when I first started, I didn't even know if it was possible to make this, like, if it was actually possible. Because like I said, I thought it was obvious someone would have solved this problem. And then when I realized that no one had, then I started to think, before I thought, oh, this is a great opportunity, I was thinking, like, is it possible? Like, maybe this hasn't been done because it's not possible. And then, you know, we were fortunate to get connected with the team that we're working with on the product. Linda Rose, who's led our product development, has, you know, over a decade of experience making consumer electronics. And so if it weren't for her, that could kind of help us figure out, okay, we will connect you to the factories that make these kinds of products, and none of them have ever made this before. So it's been a journey not only for me, who was new to the world of manufacturing, but even for people who have been veterans in the space and manufacture goods. We all have been, you know, troubleshooting and figuring out the answers to these as we go along, which is exciting. But also, you know, when you hit a snag, there's really no conventional answer to that problem, right?
Right. And when you're making something that is both a piece of electronics and a piece of jewelry, I would say with the advent of the iPhone, there's been an expectation of heft and quality, and people pick an item up, an object, and now you've got one that has to be both things and good at both things. And people expect it needs to feel, you know, like feel like quality, or they'll dismiss it.
Yes. There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into a well-designed, well-functioning product. And we have done a lot of work on this. And, you know, even now, us testing it and doing all of those things, we still have so many assumptions. There's so much that you just really won't know until it's out in the wild, right? Mm-hmm. And so that all terrifies me just a little bit. But, you know, I just keep trying to think of every possible use case and how we can try to do that. So, anyway, I think that the design, aspects of it, and kind of how that comes together with the technology and, you know, the facets of what you can and can't do with manufacturing are constantly being navigated and kind of, what's the word? Like, in balance, like you're constantly trying to balance those things.
Mm-hmm. And, what is your background, one, in creation of technical pieces of hardware?
No, actually, it's not. But what I like to say is that I am a creator. I love to create things. I love to, you know, make things from scratch. I have a lot of hobbies, and, I just really have always gotten a lot of, gratification out of being able to build things, physical things, but also, you know, in from like more of a concept type of view, just getting in there and figuring out the answers to problems and being able to create a solution for that. And so, but in terms of where the expertise comes in on the manufacturing and technical side, that is absolutely the team that we are working with.
So would you say that when people are, if people are listening and they have an idea and maybe they haven't gone out and made that a reality because they thought, well, I don't know anything about hardware, I don't know anything about software or whatever. If they have that DNA, like you just described, that maker DNA, then there's no reason that they shouldn't go and make their vision a reality.
Yeah, I think that it's very possible. It really is, because the thing is none of these things can be adequately built or created by just one person, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you did have the expertise and you knew everything that you needed to do. Actually, here's an example, because this is like one facet of my business that that we worry about. When you think about marketing, and I have experience in marketing, I know a slew of things that we should and need to be doing on the marketing side, but I can't do them because I have all of these other things that I have to do, and like that take precedence or priority over that. And so, you know, we end up bringing on people to kind of help with that, right? And you have to, you know, vet them and hope that they have the right experience and the right instinct, really, to do well and to do the right things. But again, so like I would say that it's the collective team. Like it all boils down to team for sure.
Hmm. I think that there's a mythology about creation of things, and people think that, like, you know, Steve Jobs single-handedly put together your iPhone in his garage. You realize there was no one else was involved, of course. But you really do need a team. So it sounds like an exercise in delegation and oversight.
Yes, absolutely that. And even in delegation, but I would say like probably not even to say in delegation for the most part, because so much of it, like we rely on people to just, like I said, kind of have the right instincts and knowing that they have the experience to trust them that they can make the right decisions. I think that, you know, we absolutely have conversations and meetings where we're regrouping and going over the list of things that need to be discussed and then figuring out what the next steps are. But having a person who even can take all of the issues and distill it into something that the team can understand to make an informed decision, that's important, right? To even be able to do that, that's like the basic thing you have to be able to have.
So there's two things that I want to understand. Let's break them down one at a time. First is, how does one put together the money for something like this? And then this team that you're talking about, you know, how do you find them? So let's talk about money. I see lots of people on Indiegogo and on Kickstarter, and they pull down what appears to be large amounts of money. And you think to yourself, wow, they made $50,000. Like, they're just rolling in the cash now. They're going to make an amazing product. You had a successful Indiegogo, but it's pretty clear from looking at your site that that is not the backbone of what was required.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. So there was money that was involved that even needed to get us to the Indiegogo campaign. And that was, you know, a couple $100,000 to get from ideation to something that was what you see when you look at our Indiegogo campaign page. And that's in, you know, the majority of that going to product development. So, you know, manufacturing is definitely an expensive proposition, like making a physical thing. And it's in part due to the cost of developing, you know, a good product. But even when you're developing something that is fairly low cost, which our product is not, so you can kind of add maybe 5 or 7 times what the normal costs are for something if you're just making like, oh, it's just a little plastic cup, right? Like, those things can even be something that can be an expensive proposition, because when you're not making something to scale, you're basically paying up front for the costs of the time and using, you know, very heavy resources to do a very small quantity or even just one of a thing. And that is expensive. But then like the other alternative in terms of, and this is kind of where we sort of veered a little bit off the course of what some hardware companies in our position do, is that you might, you know, build the prototype in your home or in your garage or what have you. And then once you get that nailed, you take that to a manufacturer so that they can produce that. But then one of the issues that these companies frequently run into is that they find that the thing they have is not manufacturable. because it wasn't made with the kinds of tools that are going to be made when you're using and making it to scale. But so either way, it can become an expensive proposition either on the front end or on the back end. But to even get to the Indiegogo campaign or the Kickstarter takes an investment of money. And then the money that you raise, you're hoping is going to be the money that will kind of help you cross the finish line. But for us, you know, the goal was, there were a couple goals, but one of the goals was to, you know, get out there and raise the funds that we needed to pay for the tooling, because that was one of the sort of largest big chunk kind of costs that we had. Was, you know, up till then we had been making these prototypes with our factory partner, but those are largely made by hand. And in order to make the pieces that, you know, make this product at scale, you essentially need to make those tools. And those tools cost money to make. So that was what we needed to make sure we had the money to do, to even allow us to be able to make large quantities of these instead of making them one at a time, right? And so that was what we were able to raise with our Indiegogo. And then in addition to that, you know, we wanted to get the feedback of the world. This was kind of really our first foray out there and sort of seeing, is there people that this resonates with? I mean, we had felt so passionate. We still feel so passionate about the fact that we need to change this idea that, you know, making something pink is what women want. And that's the version that we need for consumer electronics. Like, there's so much more we can be doing to really have beautiful design that people love and embrace, because technology is everywhere now. It's not just something that sits on the fringe of society where it's just, you know, nerds and geeks that care about that. It's everybody cares about technology now.
Hey, this is Scott. I wanted to tell you about LLBL Gen Pro, the leading entity modeling designer for your favorite .NET OR mapping framework. Version 5 was just released with some exciting new features like derived models, support for DTO class models, document databases, real-time validation, one-click relational model synchronization, and much, much more. You can read all about it at llblgen.com. That's llblgen.com. It's a fantastic product. It's been around for years, and you should check it out. LLBLGen.
Yeah, it does seem like there is a certain kind of inclusivity in technology right now. And I think kind of it started with tablets and the idea that everyone can be a nerd, and it doesn't have to be, a nerd doesn't have to be a thing that excludes. It can be an inclusive, enthusiasts are nerds. Nerds are people who like nice things that work.
Absolutely. I think people embrace nerdiness a lot more now than, you know, than when we were coming up in the world.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that's really impressed me about your whole kind of lifestyle brand here is that you're so open about the process. On the Tinsel blog at tinsel.me, you've got not just, you know, a, hey, here's the status of the project kind of a blog post, but it's like, here are precise measurements of how it looked before and what we changed and how it improved. And it was great. You thought it was great before, but now it's 40% thinner. You know, it's really very transparent. You're giving the right amount of detail that makes the customer feel confident that, you know, things are moving forward.
Yeah. It's really important to me and to the rest of the team that we try to share as much of the journey as possible. And I don't know, I think it probably stems from the fact that, you know, we kind of feel like we're sort of the ragtag version of a team that's bringing a product to life like this. And to me, it's a dream to even be able to have the opportunity to work on this and be doing this. And the fact that we have done as much as we have in sort of, I guess, almost the year and a half that I've been working on Tinsel is incredible. And I really want to, if nothing else, sort of bring to light to people that, like, it's just a series of steps, right, that got you from point A to point B. Not to say that any of those steps are easy, but like you can, if you can put one foot in front of the other, so to speak, then like you can kind of try to build your dream, right? It's very much, like I said, dependent on having the right people to help you do it. And that, you know, in itself, we could unpack a little bit more, I guess. But like, you know, somebody like me who doesn't have experience in manufacturing or developing a tangible good can, you know, go one day into a store and see my product on the shelf. Like, it's amazing. And honestly, like the thing that is also interesting that I think we overlook is that, you know, people do this all the time, right? Like there's so many, I mean, there's, it tends to be in a different kind of channel and universe. But if you think of some of those things that come on at 3 o'clock in the morning, these like as seen on TVs, like, oh, you know, it'll like poach your eggs and also make you waffles, right? Like,
somebody
like me basically kind of had a similar journey, right? Like, it's not like that person was just like, you know, going to school and studying, you know, egg poaching and waffle making, but like they had an idea and they were able to pull together the right resources to make it happen. So I don't know. I want to try to like make it so that people understand that it's if you want to do this, there's a way you can try to find a way to do this, I think.
Yeah. It seems to me like I'm hearing you say that there's something to be said for simply not stopping, like forward motion, even the tiniest little iterations is forward motion. And the difference between you and someone who might be listening who hasn't done this is that you simply have not given up and have no intention of giving up.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I will absolutely say that it's not easy. You know, some of the challenges that come your way, but I think that, you know, the not giving up thing is critical and to say like, oh, you don't give up. Like, I don't even want to play that down. Like, it's like something that you just like, nothing gets to you or you never feel like down about how things are going that day.
Really?
I think that, you know, behind that statement is a lot of, you know, things to take your mind off of it, being able to kind of walk away from it, having some friends and hobbies and things that you can kind of like, you know, resync yourself and sort of recenter yourself, because there's going to be a lot of that needed when you hit a wall, because you're going to hit lots of walls. It's just like, are you going to let that stop you? You're going to try to climb over it, you know?
Oh, really? So you don't just float out of bed on a rainbow and say, this thing today, people?
Oh, if only. If only.
You know, it's interesting because from the outside, you know, we see successful Indiegogo, we see successful Kickstarter. We go about our lives, and then a year later, a product pops out. And notice, I remember I saw the Be Sweet Lemonade girl on TV, and she gets $60,000. I'm like, that's amazing. And then I go about my business, and then a year later, she's got a $1 million deal with Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. And of course, my mind draws a line between point A, which is Shark Tank, and point B, which is $1 million deal. And now she's like 11, and I'm completely yada, yada, yada'd over all of the actual hard work. You know, I have no doubt that there's like a whole team there working with her to make sure that that's successful now. But it's so easy to downplay that hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, the highlights are very easy to highlight. But it's, I think that most of the real work is what happens in between those high points.
So there's the raising of the money, which is done in varying ways, Indiegogo or Kickstarter only being one of those. But the other one that is interesting is access to the right people. It sounds like you really cannot sing the praises of your team enough for, you know, you've assembled a team, but you also somehow had access to those people. How did that come down?
Yeah, so in this, I feel like I will always be so incredibly grateful for knowing the person who, without this, I feel like I wouldn't have been able to start this. It would have just been one of those, yeah, that's a cool idea. And then I would have like gone and, you know, worked a regular job. And one day maybe I would see it and be like, I had that idea, right? Like that happens to all of us. I think the thing that, that made the difference was knowing the right person. So it started off like when I first had the idea, the first thing that I did was just try to thinking like, okay, I need a designer who can help me like take this out of my head and like make it something visual. And so I started contacting a bunch of designers that I know. And then realizing that I needed an industrial designer because like not all designers can design physical things. Like that was the first thing, like first lesson. And then what happened was I ended up asking around if people knew industrial designers. And one of the people that I asked was, Tom Cadis, who was he's the chairman of Voxer. At the time, he was also the CEO, but it's his company. He founded it. And, you know, he had had some success, before starting that company, but I worked there for a few years. And so Tom had gotten to know me really well. We got to know each other really well. And so, you know, I'm like, Tom knows people. Let me ask him if he knows any designers. And so that was really the impetus really of everything, because he knew, the person who's now our advisor, his name's Ed Kilduff, and he is an industrial designer that's done, you know, a whole slew of things. But like, it seemed like, okay, this, like, let me talk to this guy because he knows stuff. So then I talked to Ed. Ed kind of gives me the rundown of like all of the different things that I need to consider if I'm going to manufacture a thing, like the real scary, are you sure you're like cut to do this kind of like conversation. Which just got me really jazzed. And then, you know, the first thing that he said that like, well, not the first thing, but maybe one of the ending things after I said, yeah, I want to do this, was he was like, you need money. If you're going to do this, you need money. And like the first person you should go ask is Tom, like go back to him and have that conversation. And so I did. And Tom, you know, over the series of a couple conversations, and me kind of explaining where I wanted to take this, supported me and gave me what I needed to see if it had legs. And that was, you know, a very rare thing. Like, A, that I knew someone who, you know, was going to believe in me enough to put money toward it, but also had the money to put toward it that I could kind of start building this thing. And so like from there, it really just kind of spread. So then, you know, between Tom and Ed helping make introductions for me, and then me reaching out to just every other person I could think of that had some relation to the things that I knew I needed to know or figure out, I just started having a bunch of coffees and lunches and dinners with people, and just trying to assemble all the pieces of how this was going to come together. But like the real key piece was an introduction that came from Ed. So again, to talk about sort of that access and network thing, he introduced me to Linda, who leads our product development. And Linda basically, you know, came in with the know-it-all in terms of like, okay, this is what we need to do. Here's who we need to contact. This is how we get started. And then everything was ready to, you know, that's when it actually began, the making of the product. So, yeah.
Is there, not to put too fine a point on it, but if you hadn't that moment taken the opportunity with that moment of access to say, do you know anybody?
Yeah.
It would have just not happened.
Yeah, totally. It's funny when you put it like that, then that's totally true.
So what is this is a tough way to ask this, but I meet lots of people at conferences. You meet people at Starbucks, you meet people in the produce aisle. And what is the difference between what you did and those people who are constantly trying to use one for access?
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? I've always have people asking me for help, but there's a moment there where you make a judgment call where you say, hey, this is a really good idea, or this person isn't slimy.
Yeah.
You know, this person isn't trying to use me in a weird way. Is it because you'd already built up relationships, or is it because of the strength of the idea? Because I know that I make a judgment call all the time when someone sends me something interesting, and I'll say, oh, yeah. And then I'll put a shoulder into it, as I like to say, and I'll, you know, help knock that door down. And then they go running down the hall. And all I did was really just push on the door.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But other people will go, yeah, I think you're trying to work the system here.
Yeah. I think it's probably a little bit of both, like idea and relationship, but I would say it's more heavily weighted in relationship. Because I like, and I said this to someone recently, that I think that, you know, more than money itself, that relationships are the most valuable currency that you can have when trying to do something like this. Because getting people's help is the only way that you're going to be able to pull these things together. Being able to get in the room with the right people that make things happen, or even have conversations where they actually are going to try to consider and try to see the vision that you have and do what they can to help. So relationships are absolutely everything. So it's not just a matter of, you know, like, so for instance, to take it back to that Tom example, it's not just that I knew Tom, but that he and I had a strong relationship. He had seen the kind of things I could do after being at his company. When I started at the company, I started part-time as an office manager. I had just moved from the East Coast and didn't know anyone, but I was interested in kind of getting in the tech industry and also meeting some new people. And so, you know, I started there kind of, you know, ordering office supplies. Like, I was like way overqualified for the job, but I was like, this is going to be fun and I want to meet people and this company's really cool. And over time, like by the time I had that conversation with Tom, like 3.5 years later, I was like running the marketing team. I was on the executive team. And so like to see, you know, Tom be able to observe and watch and be a part of me coming through that organization and all of the things that sort of played into that. Tom had an idea of like, okay, she's a person that can make something happen. I don't know if this is possible even. She doesn't know if this is possible even, but if there's a person who can try to do that, it's probably her.
Right. You know, there's that famous quote that says, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And I don't think that we dig into that preparation part enough, because preparation isn't just, you know, a person alone in their garage prepping and then waiting for, you know, opportunity and then calling the whole thing luck. Preparation is spending 10 years building relationships.
Yeah.
You know, building an, building a tribe, building a network, going out into the world and spreading positivity. And then there's a moment when all of those things come together and someone says, yeah, here, here you go. And again, it's not that, they did any work for you. They simply unlocked a door, or as I like to say, showed you a window you didn't realize was open. And then, you know, you jump through it and then there you go.
Yeah, no, that's totally a thing. In fact, I would even press that even more and say, in terms of preparation, when I think of just the way that I grew up in a family business. My family, particularly my grandmother, my father's mother, she spent so much time with me and my cousins, as we were growing up as kids, cultivating us to have the skills that we needed to be good workers in the world and to be able to do things and accomplish things and figure things out. I mean, like, you know, when I was, I don't know, maybe around like 10 or so years old, she had me kind of working in the hair salon, making appointments for people and, you know, on a computer, learning sort of Mavis Beacon typing software. So I knew how, like all these kinds of things, like showing me how to like launch a program from like DOS and like figure, you know, like how to be comfortable at a computer and how to use it. And, you know, like I was using Windows when I was a kid and it was like, it was a thing. And that was because she felt like, you know, those facets of being able to work in an office and knowing how things worked in business were really important. So some of those things I think are just kind of ingrained in me that a lot of people don't learn until much later in their lives. So preparation is key there too, I'd say.
We spend so much time trying to teach people to code, and I think we forget how to teach people how to just shake hands and be humans and talk to each other.
Yeah. I will have to put that one on my dad. He's like the most social. He will make friends with anybody in a room. And he used to do this thing to me where we would go and be at like, you know, social events, and he would just like, you know, push me out there and tell me, you're going to introduce yourself to 3 people in this room. Like before we leave, like you're going to go and you're going to get that person's card. Like that's like the thing, you know? So now I feel like I can definitely hold my own in a room and I'm not afraid to go out and introduce myself to someone, but that's not a thing that a lot of people kind of grow up with, with that kind of pressure. Go introduce yourself.
Very cool. Well, people can go to Tinsel, TINSEL.ME, And you can actually reserve your Dipper audio necklace right now, can't you?
That's right.
Shipping spring of 2016. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.